Jumbo, sitting beneath a tarp slung between two trees and one of the land cruisers.
How'd it go? Ash asked.
Not well, Harvath replied. We need to talk.
The Brit motioned to the other land cruiser. Inside, Harvath pulled his poncho off and threw it on the back seat. Ash handed him a towel and asked,
What happened? Someone hit the clinic.
Hit it how?
It looks like a team of shooters came in.
The Brit stared at him.
The rebels? FRPI?
Not unless they travel with sanitation teams.
It was sanitized?
Harvath nodded.
Right down to digging the slugs out of the wall and patching the holes.
It was a professional hit then.
That's what it looks like.
It didn't make any sense.
It's a charity clinic,
Ash replied.
Why would anyone waste those kinds of resources on it?
Harvath shrugged.
No idea.
Bullshit.
I'm serious.
No, you're not, the Brit stated. You've been holding out on us since you arrived. I don't believe for a second that you came to do some sort of assessment. You're here to compile an after-action report.
Lying to people was part of Harvath's job, but he hated doing it. Ash was completely correct. Harvath had been holding out on him. It was just the way things had to be done. At this point, though, he needed the man's help more than he needed to keep any further secrets from him.
Several days ago, said Harvath, CARE International received a video. It showed four gunmen entering the Matumeni clinic and opening fire.
Who sent the video?
We don't know.
Who took the video?
We don't know.
When was it taken?
We don't know that either.
Ash narrowed his eyes in the semi-darkness of the land cruiser and tried to read Harvath's face.
What do you know?
What I just told you.
But you haven't told me anything, except that there were four gunmen. What did they look like? Were they black, white, purple? How were they dressed?
Harvath removed his phone, powered it on, and showed him the footage.
Those are bloody biohazard suits.
Harvath nodded and waited until Ash had watched the full clip.
Play it again, the Brit said.
Harvath did as he requested. When the video was over, he took his phone back. Ash was not happy.
You and Decker went into the clinic, didn't you?
Don't worry, Harvath said. We wore protective gear.
What do you mean, don't worry? What the hell is going on here?
We don't know.
You knew enough to bring protective gear with you, the Brit said, adding, That's why you wanted us to wait here, isn't it?
Harvath nodded.
And you never thought any of this was worth sharing?
I was under orders not to.
The hell you were!
I told you. We don't know what's going on here either, Harvath emphasized. The last thing CARE wants is a scandal.
Scandal? You've got a bloody international incident!
Try selling that to the U.S. State Department.
Harvath thought to himself.
Listen, mate, those shooters didn't go in kitted up like that just to freak out the natives. There was something bad inside that clinic that they were very afraid of.
I agree.
So what was going on there? What would cause an armed team in biohazard suits to just show up?
No one on our side knows. It's just a basic medical clinic, period. They don't treat highly communicable diseases.
Apparently, somebody thought they did, replied Ash. And it was somebody serious, because, according to you, after the wet work was done, they sent in a mop-up team to sterilize the scene.
So let's narrow that down, Harvath said.
How do I know you're not carrying whatever was in that clinic?
Because I told you, we wore protective gear.
You've told me a lot of things.
He was pissed. Harvath would have been too if their positions had been switched.
We wore full biohazard suits and followed the strictest decon procedures.
That's what was in the packs, not medical supplies.
Correct, Harvath replied.
Ash shook his head.
About that wet work team, Harvath continued.
But Ash held his hand up, interrupting him.
Our fee has just doubled. And if I find out you have held anything else back, I'm going to double it again.
I'll have to call back to the States to get approval for that.
This isn't a negotiation, Ash stated. You hired us under false pretenses and watered down the scope. The fee is double, or we pack up and drive you back to Bunya right now. Which is it?
Harvath didn't like having his balls busted, but the man was within his rights. He agreed to the increased fee. Then he steered him back to his previous question.
Narrow down for me who might have sent in a wet work team and followed it up with cleaners.
Narrow it down?
It could have been any foreign intelligence service in the First World, or from the Second, for that matter. How do you narrow that down?
Let's start with how many of them are operating in Congo.
If they're smart, all of them are. Congo's untapped mineral resources alone are valued at over $24 trillion. That's more than the GDP of the U.S. and Europe combined.
But what nation specifically would you be focused on? Harvath asked.
Ash thought about it. You've got everyone from the Australians to the Swiss running a mining operation here. That includes the Chinese and Japanese as well. Even the Moroccans have established a presence.
But whose intelligence service would send out a wet work team?
The Brit shook his head.
The question isn't who, but rather, why? As in, why would any foreign intelligence service give two whits about some medical clinic in the middle of nowhere?
His point was well taken. It was the same question Harvath had been asking himself since seeing the clinic. But perhaps it wasn't the question that was wrong. Maybe it was how he was asking it.
Let's back up and start again, Harvath stated. Why would anyone send a wet work team into a medical clinic in the first place?
That seems fairly obvious, Ash replied. To make sure that someone, or something, never got out of there. And based on how those shooters were suited up, I'll bet they were after someone who was infected.
Harvath concurred.
So let's assume for a minute that they were trying to contain something. Why not just quarantine the clinic? Why go in shooting?
Ash paused again and thought about the question. Finally, he said,
because whatever they have, it's beyond bad.
Even if it were beyond bad, Harvath replied, you quarantine the victims and make them as comfortable as possible. You don't kill them.
So what's the answer then?
I don't know, he said, as he reached up and ground his thumbs into his temples.
This entire clusterfuck of an assignment was turning into one big headache. After thinking about it some more, Ash attempted to come at it from another angle.
Do you have any clue what they did with the bodies?
Harvath nodded.
That's the next thing we need to discuss.
Chapter 17. Friday. By the time Decker was awake and out of her hammock, Harvath had already gone. He had taken Ash and Mick with him. While Jumbo and the Brute Squad broke down the camp, Harvath and the two other Brits proceeded to the pit on foot. They wanted to establish a perimeter before calling in the rest of the team. The rain had stopped overnight, and when the first pale streaks of dawn began to paint the sky, it looked as if it would be a halfway decent morning. Harvath wanted to take it as a good omen, but he knew better than to put his trust in that kind of thing. Rain or shine, this was still Congo. Per Ash's request, they had given the clinic a healthy berth on their hike in. They had stopped to survey it at a distance from the jungle, but only for a moment, and then had pushed on. As soon as they neared the pit, they could smell the jet fuel. While it wasn't as strong as it had been the night before for Harvath, it was still unmistakable. They worked their way around the pit and conducted a preliminary reconnaissance in the semi-darkness. None of them spoke. They all knew what this place was. You could feel it. Ash sent Mick out to the road as a lookout and then called in the rest of the team. The sun was just beginning to pierce the trees when the white land cruisers rolled up. Decker stepped out of LC-1 wrapped in a fleece and holding a coffee cup. Her hair was pulled back and tied in a ponytail. She arched her shoulders and lazily looked around, as if she had just shown up for a 5K and was searching for the sign-in table. Then, the odor of jet fuel found its way into her nose, and her demeanor completely changed. Her eyes found Harvath's as he walked over to her.
We'll have good light in about 10 more minutes, he said. You can still opt out of this. I'll have them move the vehicles back, and one of the guys will stay with you.
Decker shook her head.
I want to do this. I have to.
Harvath wasn't going to fight with her.
Okay. What's that smell?
She asked.
Jet fuel.
Did they use it to burn the bodies?
Probably.
Closing her eyes, she leaned into him and placed her head against his shoulder.
Seeing death up close never gets any easier, does it?
It was one of the first purely human glimpses he had seen of her.
No, he replied. It doesn't.
He knew the Brits were watching, and he didn't care. Like most pure moments, though, this one was fleeting. Decker straightened up, turned her back on him, and walked around to the other side of the Land Cruiser to drink her coffee and watch the sunrise. Harvath removed his Toughbook laptop, placed it on the back seat, and turned it on. He had already uploaded the video footage from the clinic and had composed a brief sit-rep for the old man. Now that he had an unimpeded view of the sky, he wanted to transmit it back to the States. Powering up his Iridium Wi-Fi cube, he set it on the roof of the SUV and angled its antenna. While it searched for satellites, he also powered up his phone to see if he had received any texts. Once the cube was connected, he watched for the message icon to light up on his phone. It didn't. Turning it off, he focused his mind on business. He had broken the video up into pieces to make it easier to transmit. Pulling up the string of encrypted emails, he hit send and then grabbed his video camera. The sun was strong enough now to begin seeing the pit. Finished with her coffee, Decker pulled a box of high-end surgical masks out of her bag and offered them around. Everyone accepted one of the disposable respirators, even Jumbo and the Brute Squad, who would be staying with the vehicles and securing the road. There was no telling what was in the pit or suspended in the atmosphere around it. Harvath doubted anything could have survived a jet fuel-assisted fire, but he knew that the remaining smoke and ash could present a whole host of health problems, and so fitted his mask over his mouth and nose. Turning the video camera on, he documented the tire tracks and tread marks leading to and from the pit. While a lot of it was nothing more than puddles of red mud, there was enough there to show what type of equipment had come through. When he had what he needed, he joined Decker, and they walked with Ash and Mick out toward the pit. It was a solemn procession. No one spoke. With the sun up, they could see the occasional wisp of smoke rising into the air in front of them. But with all of the rain, how was that even possible? The horrific answer became clear soon enough. Like most of the terrain they had been through, the area surrounding the clinic was mostly sloped. The same could be said for where the staff disposed of their trash. It was a narrow, level strip at the base of a steep nearby hill. But it was what had been done with the hill that turned their stomachs. Even through their masks, the smell of jet fuel was now overpowering. Harvath took one look at everything and knew why. A bulldozer had definitely been brought in, but not to bury bodies. It had been brought in to engineer a grisly crematorium. A huge chunk had been ripped out of the bottom of the hill to create the oven. With Decker following behind, Harvath climbed to the top and let his nose be his guide. It didn't take long to find the empty fuel barrels hidden beneath a makeshift blind. Each one had been punctured with a small hole. Several yards away, he uncovered the air shaft and knew exactly what he was looking at. He also knew why the satellite image had looked off to him.
"What is all of this?" Decker asked as he recorded it.
"A giant rocket stove."
"What's a rocket stove?"
Harvath pointed to the shaft and then at the barrels.
"Oxygen would have been sucked in from the base of the hill and drawn up through this shaft. Those punctured barrels of jet fuel would have continued to drip feed the fire. The stronger the fire got, the more oxygen would have been sucked in. And the more oxygen that got sucked in, the hotter the fire would have raged. The temperature would have been amazing, total combustion of almost anything placed down there."
"Including bodies?"
"If they stacked them right."
Decker suddenly didn't feel so well. Harvath noticed that her color was off.
"Are you okay?"
he asked.
"I'll be fine."
"You sure?"
She nodded,
It's just the jet fuel. Can we walk back down?
Of course, he replied, offering her his arm. Decker accepted it, but let go halfway when the trail became too narrow for them to walk side by side. At the bottom, Ash and Mick were studying something at the edge of the pit. As he saw the Americans approach, Ash raised his hand for them to stop.
You don't want to see this, he warned.
See what?
Decker replied, undeterred. Mick turned and gently tried to block her, but she nudged him out of the way. She took one look and came charging back past Harvath with her hand over her mask. Seconds later, she was in the brush, vomiting.
Are you okay?
He asked, but she waved him off. He looked over at Ash, who motioned for him to come see what they had found. Harvath knew it wasn't going to be good. The men stepped aside as he joined them. On the ground, at their feet, were the skulls of three small children. Beyond was a jumble of bones, also small. While any loss of innocent life was lamentable, the loss of children was doubly so. Though he didn't want to, Harvath raised the video camera and recorded everything. There was one thing that still didn't make sense: the size of the pit. If you were just going to murder the people at the clinic, why did this have to be so big? It didn't make any sense. He was taking close-up shots when Mick asked,
What happened to Dr. Decker?
Harvath paused the camera and looked around. He didn't see her either.
Maybe she went to get a fresh mask, said Ash, or a toothbrush.
She probably just needed a break, thought Harvath. This was hard for anyone to handle.
I'll go look for her, he said, handing the camera to Mick.
Don't go too far, Ash warned.
Stepping away from the pit, Harvath looked uphill toward where the fuel barrels were. He doubted she had gone back up there, but he climbed the hill just to make sure. There was no trace of her. She must have gone back to the vehicles. Walking back down the trail, he got to the bottom and headed back toward the Land Cruisers. But as he got closer and could see everybody but Decker, his internal alarm system started to go off. When Jumbo, Simon, and Eddie all confirmed that they hadn't seen her, he radioed Ash and Mick and made his concern official. Chapter 18. Eddie and Simon were exceptional trackers. Starting from where Decker had last been seen, they worked the ground inch by inch until they had picked up her trail. Decker appeared to have started back toward the vehicles, but then had diverted for some reason. They couldn't figure out why. Then they came across another set of tracks. She appeared to be following someone. Whoever it was, he was leading Decker due west, directly away from the pit. Harvath was pissed off at her all over again.
What was she doing?
He could not have been clearer with her.
Damn it.
She seemed determined to get all of them killed, including herself. Walking off, though, was soon no longer the worst part. 200 meters into their hunt, Eddie picked up on a third set of tracks. Decker was being followed. Ash signaled for them to split up. He took Simon and Mick into the jungle to flank, while Harvath and Eddie stayed on Decker's trail and closed the gap with whoever was following her. Despite his size, Eddie moved with incredible speed. He ran with his lips pulled back, his jet-black Van Dyke highlighting two sharp canine teeth that made him look like some kind of giant vampire. While Harvath was tripped up twice along the overgrown path, Eddie never once lost his footing. It was like watching an enormous jaguar tear through the jungle. And then, out of nowhere, he put on the brakes, thrust his left hand behind him, and signaled for Harvath to stop. Harvath did as he was ordered, and waited while Eddie surveyed something in front of them. Finally, he waved Harvath up to join him. Cradling the shotgun he had taken from LC-1, Harvath crept up to where Eddie was on his stomach, peering through the foliage. Through a quick series of hand signals, the Brit relayed to Harvath what he had seen. He parted a cluster of ferns and rolled to his left so Harvath could peer through. In the distance was a small village. There couldn't have been more than 10, perhaps 13 individual huts,
as well as a smattering of animal pens and some sort of communal pavilion.
"Which one?"
Harvath whispered.
"The big one,"
Eddie replied.
3 o'clock.
He had a small monocular with him, and he handed it to Harvath so he could surveil the village. After the pavilion, the hut was the largest structure in town, which wasn't saying much. There were pens, but they were empty. There were no animals, no signs of life at all. No children, no smoke from cook fires, no nothing. It was a ghost town.
"Are you positive?"
Harvath asked. Eddie nodded.
"Can you laze it for Ash?"
The man nodded, and hailing his boss over the radio, relayed everything to him. He then removed a black tube, the size of a half-smoked cigarette, and depressing its switch, painted the roof of the big hut with a tiny green laser. Ash radioed back and confirmed the target. Now, all they had to do was come up with a plan. Harvath snapped a mental grid over the scene and surveyed the village one slice at a time. He was trying to figure out two things. First, where was everyone? And second, was this a trap? What looked like heavy tire tracks on the edge of the village helped bring the picture quickly into focus. Handing the monocular to Eddie, he showed him what to look for. Once the man had seen it, he radioed Harvath's plan to Ash, who agreed. Stepping out of the jungle, Harvath and Eddie cautiously made their way down to the village. There was sparse cover and concealment, and they took turns moving and providing overwatch for each other. In any other situation, exposing themselves by running through so much open space would have been insane, but the circumstances offered no other alternative. When they made it to the village, they pulled up at the first hut, flattened their backs against the wall, and took several heavy but quiet gulps of air. Once their breath had begun to return, they tried to listen beyond the thudding of their hearts and the blood rushing in and out of their ears. Was there any sound coming from inside that hut? They waited and listened. After enough time had passed, Harvath directed Eddie to the hut's lone window on that wall as he made his way forward in anticipation of hitting the front door. At the edge of the wall, Harvath flashed Eddie the 5-second signal and then disappeared from view. Coiled tighter than a jack-in-the-box, Eddie began counting backward, ready to pop into the window. Harvath slipped beneath the hut's front window and positioned himself outside the front door. As he mentally kept track of the countdown, he placed his hand against the door and applied a whisper of pressure. This was a village in the Aturi rainforest. It was amazing there were even doors. He didn't expect to find any locks. When his countdown hit zero, he applied pressure against the door. Encountering no resistance, he swung it open wide and spun inside. At the same moment, Eddie and his AK-47 announced themselves via the window. The hut, as they had expected, was empty. Harvath did a quick reconnaissance while Eddie extricated himself and took up a defensive position outside. There was nothing at all to tell Harvath what had happened. Everything seemed to be normal. As best he could tell, the family in this hut had been living their lives the way they normally did, until something had happened. And they had all disappeared. Seeing a doll lying in the corner, Harvath corrected himself. The people of this village hadn't disappeared. They had been cremated. Death dripped from the thatched rooftops of this village. The sooner they could get Decker and get the hell out of here, the better he was going to feel. Stepping back outside, he waved Eddie up to the next hut and let him clear it. It was empty, as was the one after that. And the one after that. The only hut that appeared to have any life was the big one, and that was where Eddie had seen a man rushing a woman who they all believed to be Jessica Decker inside. One hut away from the big one, Harvath and Eddie stopped and crouched down.
"I guess we now know why the burn pit was so large," the Brit said.
It didn't make any sense.
Why would they need to take out an entire village? Maybe they were all infected.
Harvath hoped that wasn't true. Not that it made any difference. These people were all dead. Their children were dead. Those were the little skulls they had seen back at the pit. There might be even more, just waiting to be uncovered. The idea of going through that little lake of ash with a rake was more than Harvath could take. He held up three fingers, counted down, and spun into the hut. It was empty, just like he knew it would be. With this side of the village secure, they waited inside for Ash and Mick to come down and join them. Simon would remain out of sight in the jungle to provide overwatch. Once the rest of the team arrived in the hut, Ash deferred to Harvath.
"She's your colleague," he said. "How do you want this to go down?"
It was a sign of respect. Technically, she was his colleague, and he should be the one making the call as to her recovery. Harvath gave Ash a nod.
"Okay," he said. "Here's how we're going to do this."
The improvised flashbang grenade Harvath had fashioned created more bang than flash, but it did the trick. Before the occupants of the hut knew what was happening, the entry team was already inside. Harvath moved to cover Decker while Ash and Mick took down the two tangos. No sooner had Harvath gotten to her than she began screaming.
"No!" she cried. "Stop!"
She fought to push Harvath out of the way and get around him. He grabbed her wrist and tweaked it, just enough to get her attention.
"That hurts!"
she protested.
"Good," he replied. "Now back up."
It wasn't a request. When she failed to move, he applied more pressure. The pain brought her up onto the balls of her feet, and he stepped her out of the hut to allow Ash and Mick to finish securing the two inside.
"Don't hurt them," she ordered.
Harvath let her go.
"Who are they?"
"The son's deaf," she replied. "The father used to help at the clinic."
"Why did you wander off?"
"I spotted the boy, and I wanted to see where he was going. I thought he could tell us something."
"You should have gotten me first."
"And what if I had lost him? What if he hadn't come back here?"
She had a point, but Harvath didn't feel like debating with her.
"I don't care what the situation is," he answered. "You don't go off by yourself. Now, why was the father following you?"
"Because he was worried."
"About the boy?"
"About everything," she exclaimed. "Look at this village. There's no one left. What do you think they filled that oven with?"
"Did he tell you that?"
Decker nodded.
"Does he know what happened?"
"He knows more than we do. A lot more."
Chapter 19. Geneva, Switzerland. Helena was angry. She was angry with everyone, with Bensi, with Damien, with her father for never finding her, never rescuing her after she was kidnapped. The one person she wasn't angry with was herself. She had an excellent quality of life in Israel. She had an apartment and a car. She shopped pretty much wherever she wanted and went to the best clubs and restaurants. She made more money in 2 months than she would have back home in Eastern Europe in a year. She had thought about modeling. In fact, she had been asked countless times by photographers to sit for them, but Bensi had forbidden it. He claimed it wasn't good for her to have photos floating around out there. It made sense, but as was usually the case with Bensi, there was what he called the truth, and then there was reality. Israel was everything to him. He would say or do anything to protect it. Bending or flat-out breaking the truth was all just part of the job. Whatever needs to be done. It was his one and only directive, and he applied it without remorse. After what he had experienced at the hands of the enemy, she couldn't blame him. But she wasn't the enemy. He didn't want her modeling because he wanted to keep her dependent upon him for everything. The schedule, the insane travel, the assignments, all of it conspired to keep her isolated. Even when she did meet men from the Mossad, it was always when they were in the field. And the ones she liked were never assigned to her team more than once. And then there was the work. While the pay was better, she was still in the sex trade. Bensi, for lack of a better word, was simply an overeducated government-employed pimp. He paid her, housed her, picked out her clothes, and told her where to go and what to do. She wasn't a Mossad agent. She was a Mossad asset, and she carried no delusions to the contrary. She was nothing more than a tool that Bensi, and on a grander scale, Israel, could use to secure things it wanted.
Tools were hard, cold objects that waited to be picked up for a job. Once that job was through, they were hung up, put in a box, or cast aside. Maybe some affection from Bensy would have made a difference. She caught snatches of it from time to time. It was why she liked to drink with him. If they were someplace he felt safe, like the house by the sea, sometimes she could get him to go beyond a second drink. That's when the real Bensy came out. Unfortunately, those times were too few and much too far in between. They weren't enough to nourish a person. She needed more, and there was a very good chance that Bensy didn't have more in him. The only way she was ever going to find out what she needed was to get out. But to get out, she needed a plan. Pierre Damien was it. The fact that Bensy believed she had fallen for him stunned her. She was a good actress, probably better than most, but she had never been able to fool him about anything. When she said she hadn't fallen for him, she had meant it. Nevertheless, he had decided to recall her. It wasn't like Bensy. Some jobs took longer than others. He knew that. She had never failed him before. She wouldn't start now. She just needed more time. This wasn't about Bensy. It wasn't even about Israel. This was about her. If she had given him what he wanted, the assignment would already be over. She wasn't ready yet. There was still something she had to put in place. When it was done, she would gladly give Bensy everything, and then she would disappear. Sitting in her apartment, she understood the pressure he was under, and though she had not seen Bensy's boss, Nava, she could sense that she was in Geneva. Bensy always acted differently when she was around. More than likely, Helena figured, it had been Nava who had pulled the plug on the assignment and had moved to have her recalled to Israel. That would explain a lot. Most of all, it would explain the high level of concern the Institute, as the Mossad was known, was expressing over Damien. Before being inserted into the United Nations, Helena had been given a heavily redacted file on him. The product of a Canadian father and an American mother, Damien possessed dual citizenship and had made his initial fortune in oil and natural gas, eventually branching out into petrochemicals and pharmaceuticals. He had been married only once and had lost his wife to cancer. They never had children, and he never remarried. Business and philanthropy were his passions. Up until his 40s, Damien's philanthropy had helped fund research into illnesses, like the cancer that had taken his wife, and had provided money to hospitals and universities, which saw his name placed on the wings of several buildings. Then, something changed. It started with a book, a small scholarly treatise that cracked a mental door. That book led to others, which led to lectures and documentaries. Those led to a re-examination of who and what he was supporting through his generous donations. He had made his money by taking from the earth, but he had never given anything back. It was an epiphany packed with revelations, one of the greatest being that he had done the world a favor by never having children. When interviewed by the media, Damien was always quite candid about his conversion and his belief that the earth couldn't sustain its current rate of human growth. Even with technological advancements like fracking, crop management, and vaccine production, there were a finite amount of resources being divided up among an exploding population. People were not only breeding like rabbits, but thanks to advances in sanitation and medicine, they were no longer dropping like flies, as one researcher had put it. Left unchecked, it was a death sentence for the planet. Damien had committed himself to doing everything he could to make sure that didn't happen. In one of the articles Helena had read, an interviewer had labeled Damien a neo-Malthusian, someone who advocated for population control programs in order to preserve existing resources for current and future generations. Damien, as he always did when people tried to put labels on him, laughed it off. The Mossad didn't, because they knew what Damien really was. In addition to being a supporter of overpopulation theory, he was a eugenicist who believed that favorable genetic qualities should be advanced, while unfavorable traits should be limited or discontinued altogether. He He dreamt of an Earth with a much reduced, healthier population. That, in and of itself, would never have been enough to rise to the attention of Israeli intelligence. People were free to subscribe to any crackpot ideas they wanted. But what had piqued the Mossad's interest in Damien was his particular enmity toward the Jewish state and the considerable wealth he was applying against it. Via multitudinous foundations and so-called advocacy organizations, he was waging a global public relations campaign bent on painting Israel as the source of all the Middle East's problems. In the United States, he sent groups into American churches to poison congregations. On college campuses, his organizations recruited addle-brained university students to spread the message about the real Israel. Then, he funded similar propaganda organizations in Israel, targeting young Israelis and convincing them their nation was evil. Was it anti-Semitism? The Mossad wondered. Anti-Zionism? A combination of both. The more the Institute looked into Damien, the more astounding the extent of his efforts became. The man seemed particularly committed to weakening Israel's relationship with the United States. Billboards and newspaper ads had been taken out exploiting low points in their relationship and highlighting events such as the spying of Jonathan Pollard. He had established a legal foundation that paid American lawyers to go after U.S. defense contractors with class-action lawsuits on behalf of Palestinians wounded and killed by U.S.-made weapons. Prostitutes were paid to sleep with and then threatened to blackmail pro-Israel members of Congress while on congressional delegations to the Jewish state. Ultimately, the hookers would back off, claiming that they had been hired by the Mossad and couldn't go through with it. And then there was the UN. Over his adult life, Damien had been offered plum international ambassadorships by three different Canadian prime ministers, each of which he had declined. Despite his professed love of Canada, where he made his home, he had been too busy running his businesses to focus on running an embassy. That changed, though, in his 60s, when he stepped back from the businesses and spent more time focused on his philanthropy. When Damien was asked to serve Canada at the United Nations and was told which position he would get, he accepted. He already had a good relationship with the Secretary General, and was honored when the General Assembly voted to appoint him to be Under Secretary General of the United Nations Population Fund. The fund touted itself as the lead UN agency for delivering a world where every pregnancy was wanted, every birth was safe, and every young person's potential was fulfilled. They prided themselves on shrinking the size of families while simultaneously making them healthier. It was the perfect place for Damien. As an Under-Secretary General, he not only received diplomatic immunity, but he was also admitted to one of the most exclusive clubs in the world, the Secretary General's Senior Management Group, or SMG for short. The 50-member SMG acted as a quasi-board of directors, advising the Secretary General and helping to ensure the coherence and strategic direction of the entire United Nations organization. The UN had always been a hotbed of anti-Zionism, but Damien was like a bellows when it came to fanning the flames. Whether it was his charisma or the esteem that members held him in because of his vast fortune, he possessed tremendous sway. He never missed an opportunity to harm Israel. He was also very anti-America. Normally, this would have provided an opportunity for the Israelis and the Americans to work together. A foreign diplomat working behind the scenes to undermine the efforts and image of both countries cried out for a concerted effort. Though his tactics were different when it came to the United States, Damien was working even harder and pumping even more money into weakening it. The sticking point was his dual citizenship. But because he held American citizenship, the United States was limited in what it could and would do to him. Had Damien been palling around with terrorists in Yemen, they would have droned him. But America took its rights of free speech and free association very seriously. Damien was free to donate to whatever causes he wished. If no laws were being broken, American intelligence made it perfectly clear that it had no desire to begin an investigation. Israel was on its own when it came to Pierre Damien. It was incredibly short-sighted on the Americans' part. While the Israelis respected the United States' views on its freedoms and founding documents, it was the height of negligence to allow those same freedoms and documents to provide cover for subversion. It was like Palestinian terrorists using hospitals and schools from which to launch rocket attacks. At some point, you had to make a choice. Do you sit still and absorb the attacks, or do you go in and eliminate the threat? As far as Israel was concerned, there was too much at stake to just sit back. The threat needed to be eliminated. And so, they had decided to go after Damien and take him out. But on the night they did, something happened that changed everything. Chapter 20. The United Nations Secretary General had planned a retreat for the full SMG to the picturesque Austrian village of Altbach. That's where the Mossad had decided to take out Pierre Damien. Nava Itzik and her Metzadah team were mobilized and tasked with the assignment. Ben Mordecai would carry out the hit. Altbach looked like it had been built by Hollywood set designers. Cradled in a narrow valley surrounded by lush meadows, the flower boxes of its wooden chalets exploded in riots of color. Soaring pines gave way to jagged mountain peaks. It was clear why it had been voted Austria's most beautiful village. Though not given to such thoughts, Bensi had found himself thinking that there was probably no more perfect place for a honeymoon. But he hadn't come to Austria for a honeymoon. He had come to kill Pierre Damien. The Institute was very nervous about the assignment, not only because their target was a diplomat who held dual American and Canadian citizenship, but also because a previous Metzadah team had botched the assassination of Mahmoud Al-Mabou, the co-founder of the military wing of Hamas. Al-Mabou had been wanted for numerous offenses, including the killing of two Israeli soldiers, as well as the purchase of arms from Iran to be used in Gaza. The Institute had tracked Al-Mabou from Damascus to the Al-Bustan Rotana Hotel in Dubai. So had Jordanian intelligence, which wanted to capture him and bring him back to Jordan to stand trial. Instead of taking a breath and figuring out how to handle the Jordanians, the Metzadah rushed their operation. Almost immediately, mistakes started happening. It was amateur hour. Though they succeeded in killing Al-Mabou, they didn't succeed in making it look like he had died of natural causes. It took 10 days, but Dubai officials eventually ruled it a homicide and began piecing together what had happened. In the end, still images from CCTV cameras of 26 Mossad agents were released to the press, as well as the names and countries of origin on the passports used to enter the country. Once the names were out there, it became evident that the Mossad had stolen the identities of Israelis who held dual citizenship in Great Britain, Ireland, France, Germany, and Australia. The Dubai authorities also arrested two Palestinian Fatah operatives who had been assisting the Mossad team. It wasn't as bad as the botched CIA operation several years earlier to snatch radical Egyptian cleric Abu Omar off the streets of Milan, but it was an embarrassment nonetheless. The Institute wanted the smallest footprint possible and absolutely no mistakes. The message had been sent from the top: if you screw up, don't come home. The Institute had done its homework. They knew Pierre Damien, his quirks and idiosyncrasies, habits and routines. They also knew diplomatic boondoggles, which was exactly what the SMG retreat to Austria was. There was always a big night at these things, and for theirs, they had rented out the best restaurant in town. That was when Nava wanted to strike. Bensi had agreed. Damien would eat too much and drink too much, making him an easier target and his accidental death all the more believable. The Undersecretary's General departed the Chalet Hotel in a convoy of vans and minibuses, accompanied by their UN security teams. The housekeeping staff had been instructed to begin their turndown as soon as the guests had left for dinner. Bensi watched from outside. Once Damien's room had been serviced, He exited his vehicle, threw on a small backpack, and approached the chalet. It was overcast, and there were no streetlights in the village. Bensi avoided the small stay-behind team and worked his way around back. It wasn't a good night for his hands. He had difficulty climbing, and it took longer than it should have. When he finally reached Damien's third-floor balcony, his hands were in a lot of pain. He always carried two pills in a small paper envelope, just in case. Pausing, he popped both and then, after pulling on a pair of special latex gloves, went to work on the lock for the large glass door. The suite resembled the pictures he had viewed on the hotel's website. The walls were clad in knotty pine, the floors covered with a patterned carpet similar to the drapes. A feather duvet lay across the foot of the bed, and a row of thick pillows in perfectly pressed cases were staged along the headboard. The crisp, white sheets had been turned down, and bottles of water had been left next to the bed, along with a card forecasting tomorrow's weather. After checking the bathroom, Bensi made his way into the sitting room. There was a couch, a coffee table, two side chairs, and a dresser. In the corner was a vintage tile stove. Not far from it was a desk. What there wasn't was a laptop. The Institute wanted a copy of Damien's hard drive. Because the death was supposed to look like an accident and not a robbery, the computer needed to remain behind. Damien had left for the dinner empty-handed, so it had to be somewhere in the room. Bensi checked the front closet, and there, on a luggage stand, was Damien's suitcase. It was a ubiquitous soft-sided piece. Its main compartment had been zippered and locked shut. Removing a pen, Bensi applied pressure to the teeth of the seam and easily opened the zippered area. Inside was a locked hard-sided briefcase. Sliding it out, he took it over to the desk. The locks were tricky, and the pain in his hands only compounded their difficulty. He took a deep breath and willed himself to slow down. Damien and his colleagues would only just be getting into their salads by this point. Even so, Bensi radioed his team surveilling the restaurant for a situation report. Once word came back that the party was still on cocktails, Bensi relaxed and focused back on the case. The thin picks were a challenge for him to hold, much less manipulate with his crooked fingers. The job should have taken seconds, not minutes. Had Nava known the state his hands were in, she would have replaced him, but she didn't know, and Bensi was determined to see his assignment through. When he finally had the case open, he lifted the lid and looked inside. There were several file folders on top. Beneath those were Damien's laptop and an additional cell phone. He had been spotted using an Apple phone, and this one appeared to be an Android. Bensi took it out and set it next to the case on the desk. The laptop would take the longest, so he decided to work on it first. Opening his backpack, he removed a small tool kit and extracted an electric screwdriver. Once he had found the right-sized head, he flipped the computer over and removed the screws from the bottom. With the cover off, he slid an incredibly sophisticated black box the size of a paperback from his pack and began attaching leads to different places inside the laptop. He then depressed a power button on the black box and began to copy the hard drive. The device used to suck the data out of the cell phone was smaller, about the size of a hockey puck. After finding the right USB cable, he connected the two and powered up the phone. As the electronics did their work, he opened the physical folders and sifted through the papers. The first two were spreadsheets with budgets, dry, boring data that appeared related to Damien's businesses. But the contents of the next folder stopped Ben Mordecai cold. The cover page was innocuously labeled Outcome Conference, yet what he found on the pages that followed was anything but innocuous. It had been prepared for a subgroup of the SMG called the Plenary Panel, or P2 for short. Bensi had never heard of it. Members of the panel were neither identified by name nor their country of origin, only by number, 1 through 7. After acknowledging a string of recent setbacks, the document outlined P2's chilling goals. 1. Decrease human population below 500 million and keep it in perpetual balance with nature. 2. Guide reproduction wisely, improving fitness and diversity. 3. Unite humanity with a living new language. 4. Redistribute global wealth under the more acceptable term, global public goods. 5. Rebalance personal rights with social duties. 6. Replace passion, faith, and tradition with reason. 7. Make clever use of new technologies to go around national governments and establish direct ties with citizens. 8. Rebrand global governance as equitable, efficient, and the logical next step in human evolution. 9. Discredit, delegitimize, and dismantle the idea of the nation-state / national sovereignty. 10. Prepare a mechanism to neutralize any challenges to United Nations authority. Ben Mordecai couldn't believe what he was reading. It was a blueprint for revolution. If Che Guevara was right and revolution wasn't an apple that fell when it was ripe, but rather was made to fall, then it looked like the plenary panel was shaking the entire global tree. They identified the biggest obstacles to achieving their goals as the United States and Israel. With the two nations overwhelmed and laid low by a massive event, the panel was confident that no one would stand in the United Nations' way. Damien's focus on weakening both countries began to make more sense. What wasn't clear, though, was what this massive event was intended to be and when it would take place. In the margins were Damien's handwritten notes. There was a three-letter designator, AHF, followed by words like pathogenicity, absolute risk, and dose response. Mordecai had more questions than answers. Did the notes refer to a chemical attack? Biological? Something else entirely? When was it set to take place? And what was Damien's role? And who were the other members of the panel? The only thing Mordecai knew for sure was that they couldn't kill Damien. Not now. Not with so many unanswered questions. After photographing all of the documents with his phone, he reassembled the laptop and put everything in the room back the way he had found it. Then, he radioed the team that they had to abort. Nava was livid. The Institute was going to be furious. She demanded to know why. Mordecai told her to trust him and then broke off communication as he slipped out of the hotel the same way he had come in. He no longer cared about the pain in his hands. All he cared about was the information that he had discovered in Damien's room. The idea that a cabal within the United Nations hierarchy was planning a coup involving something so catastrophic that Israel and the United States would be too overwhelmed to respond was almost unimaginable. Almost. He had seen enough to know that anything was possible, especially when it came to those who sought power. Around the world, the majority of countries were ruled either by dictatorships or some form of democratic socialism. In those nations, power resided in the state. Only a handful of countries were truly free, with power residing in the hands of individual citizens. Any attempt to seat some sort of global system of government would have to sideline Israel and the United States first, or it would never succeed. In his notes about dealing with the United States, Damien had scribbled two letters, MC. Were they initials? Roman numerals? He was anxious to have minds back at the Mossad unpack everything and begin connecting the dots. While Nava had been angry about Mordecai pulling the plug on her operation, when he showed her the documents, she eventually conceded that it had been the right thing to do. Once they were back in Tel Aviv and had turned over all the materials to the Institute, all they could do was wait. Their biggest expectation was for what would be pulled off Damien's hard drive and cell phone. Both turned out to be a bust. He was using a new form of encryption that they had never encountered before. Without his passwords, there was no telling how long it would take to crack. And even if they could crack it, there was no telling what they would find and if it would be in time. That was why Mordecai had decided to activate Helena. With her background working for a human trafficking NGO, it didn't take much to align her with a program at the United Nations in Geneva. She used her Eastern European passport. There was nothing in her file, or the apartment that had been set up for her, to connect her to Israel. The fact that she was not a UN employee, but rather working on a co-UN NGO trafficking program, was especially important. Damien wouldn't have wanted to run afoul of the UN's code of ethics regarding dating subordinates. It happened all the time, but he took his role as Under-Secretary General seriously. He didn't need a scandal hovering over him, not with everything he had planned. All Bensi had to do was dangle Helena. Damien's dick would take over and do the rest. He was well known for the attractive women he dated. His relationships were like monsoon season, steamy and short. He showered his girlfriends with gifts and expensive trips, and as soon as he grew bored, he was on to the next. He liked the ambiance of the bar at La Réserve Genève Hotel. The views were exceptional. They had an excellent selection of whiskies, vodkas, and cognacs, and their sushi chef was top-notch. The fact that it was close to his apartment was icing on the cake. Bensi parked Helena in a provocative but stylish cocktail dress at La Réserve Genève and let nature take its course. Damien wasn't shy. He made a beeline right for her, and she played him like a pro. They had one drink together before she announced that she had to leave. He offered her a ride home. She declined. He asked if he might have her phone number. She said no. He offered her his personal card with his cell phone number written on the back. She placed it on the table and didn't bother to pick it back up. The only personal information she had revealed was that she was temporarily assigned to a human trafficking project at the UN. The next day, there were flowers on her desk. Inside the envelope was the card Damien had handed her and which she had left on the table the night before. She gave the flowers to one of her colleagues. The cat-and-mouse game continued on with Helena playing disinterested and hard to get. It drove Damien wild. He wasn't used to women saying no to him. He kept coincidentally bumping into her. His unsettling manservant come assistant, Jeffrey, had been following her. She had spotted him each time, but had never let on. Finally, she gave in and agreed to dinner. To his credit, he didn't overdo it. He picked a small local restaurant with exceptional food. He was a gentleman and very charming. For their second date, he asked her what kind of food was her favorite. She said Italian. He flew her to Rome in his private jet, and she ate the best meal of her life. After their third date, she began sleeping with him. It was the best sex Pierre Damien had ever had. Bensi had given her one task: to capture the man's passwords so they could access his hard drive and cell phone. To do that, she had been issued what looked like a wall charger for her cell phone, but what in reality was a covert keystroke logger. It had the ability to sniff, decrypt, log, and report all keystrokes within its immediate vicinity. It even had a small rechargeable internal battery that allowed it to work even after being unplugged. All she had to do was to position it near Damien when he was logging onto his devices. As she had explained multiple times to Bensi, that was a lot harder than it sounded. Damien never used his laptop around her, and the only phone she ever saw him use was his iPhone, which he unlocked with his fingerprint. Eventually, she assured him, she would get the passwords. It would just take time. But then, everything changed. Bensi had told her she was being recalled and told her to go back to her apartment, wait for his call, and not have any contact with Damien other than to feign illness. How Bensi thought he would ever be able to get anyone closer to Damien was beyond her. He was going to toss it all away, toss his precious Israel to the wolves. It was beyond insane. Then her phone had rung. It was Bensi. He wanted to make her an offer, or more appropriately, he wanted to offer her an incentive. "Go ahead," she had said. Gripping the phone, she listened as the Mossad agent laid it all out.
Her first reaction was panic. He had used a name they had agreed never to speak of. Like Damien previously showing up every time she went out, she didn't believe this was a coincidence either. Bensie was either lying to her or had been lying to her all along.
"How do I know I can trust you?"
she asked. It was one of the biggest enticements he could have ever placed in front of her. The Israeli known as Enoch ran the trafficking ring that had kidnapped her back home and had forced her into the sex trade. She wanted to exact her revenge on him almost as badly as she wanted out of her life with the Mossad. Almost. Offering up Enoch was an act of desperation. Bensie knew he couldn't pull off his operation without her. Whatever Damien was planning, it was already in motion. If it was as devastating as the Mossad feared, they needed to get to the bottom of it now. She, on the other hand, didn't care what happened to Israel. She didn't care what happened to the United States either. If everything went according to her plan, she would be so far away from both, anything could happen, and it wouldn't matter. All she cared about was getting out. But if she could figuratively run over Enoch and drag his corpse through the parking lot as she made her exit, it would close several disturbing chapters in her life and allow her to move on from a very troubling part of her past. Bensie knew she had been dragging her feet. He just didn't know why. After threatening to recall her to Tel Aviv, he was now offering her an incentive to stay and finish the job. Typical Mossad. Stick first, then carrot. She was going to have to push things, which meant there was a good chance she might screw up and walk away with nothing. But it was too good an opportunity to pass up. Taking a deep breath, she opened her lingerie drawer and said into the phone,
"Deal."
Chapter 21. Congo. Harvath never took his eyes from the man or his deaf son. Speaking to Jumbo, he said,
"Ask him again."
The translator did, and Harvath studied the man's face for any indication that he was lying. He was looking for micro-expressions, sometimes referred to as tells. They were subconscious facial cues that indicated that a person was under duress because they were lying or had intent to do some other type of harm. So far, he didn't see any. When the man replied, Jumbo translated. Harvath didn't see any signs that the man was lying. In fact, everything about him suggested he was telling the truth.
"Ask him about the video," Harvath said. "Who filmed it?"
Jumbo posed the question and then listened to the man's response. Finally, he turned to Harvath and said,
"He took the video."
"He did?"
Jumbo nodded.
"With what?"
Jumbo asked the man and then replied,
"With his cell phone."
Harvath didn't believe him.